Successful, and you of course had in the Air Force. I believe, if I'm right, I don't have your bio in front of me, but you made it to Lieutenant Colonel.
Yes.
And did you or did you not see a UFO while you were in the Air Force?
No, I never saw them while I was in the Air Force. I had one experience with a UFO airborne years after I got out, when I was delivering an airplane, a mail plane, back east to Detroit.
And you actually had an experience there?
Well, I'll tell you, it was midnight, and I was beginning to make my position report over the radio beacon at Indianapolis. And as I was speaking on the radio, I saw ahead of me what looked like small blinking colored lights. It looked like if you took a ball of Christmas lights, squeezed them together into a pancake, and then put them out there in front of the airplane and turned it on. All these little colored lights were blinking all over the top and the bottom and all around it. And I was talking to the control people already. I said, "Who's out here with me?" And they said, "There's nobody out there with you." I said, "There is somebody out here with me, and he's at my altitude on a collision course. In air, you have 1,000 feet separation. If you're going east, everybody's going at an odd 1,000 feet. If you're going west, everybody is even 1,000. You can't run into each other. This guy is coming west at 9,000 feet, which is clearly a violation of regulation." So I said, "He is out here, and he's at my altitude, and he's coming right towards me." And they said, "We are not painting anything on the radar." I said, "Well, he's definitely there, and I've got to turn." So I made a right turn. You turn right to pass, let him pass on the left, and he turned to his left. We were on a collision course again. I turned more, and he turned more, and we're still on a collision course. So I rolled out to the left and back around again to get a better look at it. Now, I didn't want to have to go through the collision. And at that point where I rolled away and came back, he was silhouetted against a big sea of yellow light that makes up Indianapolis at night. Then I could see that it was a dark lenticular form, about 10% to thickness to diameter. A big one. He was bigger than maybe two or three Boeing 747s nose to tail between me and the city. And he's starting to make a turn to the right about 30 degrees and heading towards Chicago. And I made a turn to the right to get closer to him to see if I could get a better view. And as I did that, it started to speed up and just went shoo, and was over the horizon.
Just like that, gone.
Like that, was gone. Flew away.
And as far as, to your knowledge, it was never painted on radar at all?
They said they never saw anything.
We're talking Wendell Lee Stevens. We're talking about crashes in New Mexico, several right there in a close time span, and not all of them, most people don't know about. They know about Roswell, of course. As you said, they got all the publicity. Why so many in New Mexico? Why so many UFOs at that time period?
Well, that was a question that puzzled everybody, including the government people. They didn't know how to account for all of this. And we got a clue in 1978 in a contact taking place in Charleston, South Carolina, where another fundamental Christian believer, didn't believe in UFOs, but a fundamentalist Christian, was involuntarily abducted, taken aboard, and after he's been examined on a table and helped off the table and allowed to walk around the craft and ask questions, he says, "Why me? Why did you pick me up?" And he still thinks he believes what his church believes, that they're devils. And they told him that they had examined 12 other potential close observances, is what they called the abduction, and that they put all the information in their computer, and it rationalized and selected the one that would contribute the most new knowledge to what they were doing. And that the computer selected Bill Herman, so they picked him up. Now, after he's aboard and had the examination, and he says, "Well, what do you want me to do? Why are you here?" And they said, "Well, we have lost one of our craft to what we considered hostile action in the western part of your land," they said. And they said, "We were hoping that somebody could contact your authorities and arrange to have them release our bodies and our residue to us." And Bill Herman said, "Why don't you do it yourself?" And they said, "Well, we tried. We sent an emissary to Washington. He tried to get to the Pentagon. He was intercepted. They tried to capture him. They successfully got back to his ship, took off. They launched rockets after him and sent fighter planes to pursue him and to shoot him down. They said, they're too hostile. Can't deal with them. We were hoping that there would be a better way to do this." He said, well, I have no clout. I don't know anybody. I can't help you at all. He says, how did you lose it? And they said that they discovered after the fact that there was a beam that they thought was a beam weapon to begin with that was rotating in a circle out there, and it had a could stop and lock on to an object. And when it's locked onto their vehicle and the lock-on lasted 90 seconds or more, it would cause the computer control system to fail and go into automatic emergency landing mode. So when we began looking for a beam that was doing this, we found that the Navy was trying to improve the radar that we had. See, when the British invented radar, it would only go out 25 miles. Then during the war, we improved it for the ships so they could look out 50 miles. Now the FAA wanted to join the radar, the field radars and ship radars in an umbrella radar, and they were trying to get out 200 miles. So the Navy was doing the research. They needed this too. The Navy was carrying the research ball, but it was being funded by NASA and other agencies trying to get 200-mile reach radar. And they were the experimentations were taking place on Mount Telluride in the Four Corners area up there just north of Roswell. It's in the corner for Colorado, New Mexico, Arizona, and Utah come together, right there in the corner. All of the crashes came down within 200 miles of that. There was 10 crashes that happened there within a year.
10?
10, no, more than that. There was the 10 that I know of.
10 that you've been able to find out about, and it was all connected with this new kind of radar?
We don't know, because most of the occupants were killed. There was a couple of them that survived at Aztec, but they were carried away, and we don't we believe now that they were taken to Los Alamos, where they had already begun preparing a habitat for any more that came down alive. And then a year later, one came down north of Kingman Air Force Base, 8 miles north of Kingman Air Force Base. And this was interesting because there were four surviving occupants in that one, too. The Army got on scene in time to take the occupants alive. They arranged to pick the vehicle up on tank transporters, and they hauled the residue to Area 51 and took the occupants to Los Alamos. So Los Alamos evidently successfully prepared a habitat, a habitat you could live in.
When we talk about the habitat, did they have some special, I guess they did have some special requirements?
I think we were experimenting. We were trying to find out special requirements because they didn't have a lot of success in keeping them alive very long. But they did take the ones from north of Kingman to Los Alamos. Now, the interesting thing about that is when they recovered the residue and took it to Area 51, it was beeping the whole time they recovered it. When they got it to Area 51, kept beeping, and the engineers couldn't figure out how to get in it, how to stop the beeping or anything else. And somebody says, why don't we send for the occupants? Have them come turn it off. They finally ended up doing that, and they called Los Alamos and had them send the occupants over. They drove them over in a carry-all and indicated by signals and motions what they wanted done. The aliens indicated they would have to go aboard to do it. There was a big discussion about could they trust them if they let them go aboard. They finally sent a guard in with them and let them go in, open it and go inside. The guard came out vomiting and real sick, and now they're in there alone, and they're wondering if they're going to activate it and take off, when pretty soon they came to the door. The beeping stopped, and they came back to the door, and they backed the carry-all up, and they came down the steps, got the carry-all, and they drove them back to Los Alamos.
Wendell Lee Stevens is our guest. We're going to wrap up the hour here.